You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of December 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
there is only one thing that we are not ready to do: be passive, resignate ourselves to another Srebrenica, another Rwanda.
UN Special Envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura, as the evacuation of East Aleppo stalls again. But the people who have got out pose another uncomfortable question. Where do they go now? My guests, Matt Alagaya, Chris Lord and Henry Rhys Sheridan, will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including: has Switzerland fudged its way to a relationship with the EU that could serve as a model for the UK? Plus, amid the doom and gloom of 2016, we'll ask, has the last year really been the complete catastrophe that it almost certainly has? And
okay, people, tomorrow morning, 10 a.m., Santa's coming to town.
Santa! Oh my God!
Santa here? I know him. I know him.
We'll ask what makes and or breaks a Christmas movie. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Matt Alagaya, Monocle's business editor, and Chris Lord, Monocle's Istanbul bureau chief, and Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan will be joining us shortly. Welcome all. We will start in Aleppo, where the evacuation of survivors of what remains of the city's last rebel-held areas appears to have ground to a halt. The brokers of the deal, Russia, Turkey, and Syria, are accusing the rebels of failing to uphold their end of the bargain, whereby they ease their own sieges of towns in Idlib province. A predictable row has now also commenced over where those who have been evacuated from Aleppo will go. Turkey plans to accept some injured refugees for treatment, but wants to build a camp inside Syria for the rest. Chris, first of all, our Istanbul bureau chief, from a domestic political point of view, how tricky is the Syrian refugee question? We're accustomed to talking about this from a European perspective, but is Turkey any more hospitably inclined than anybody else?
I mean, they've hosted so many million Syrian refugees throughout this whole crisis. But one has to only really look at the numbers, which is unemployment is rising very quickly in Turkey. And in fact, the latest figures show a quite substantial rise has happened. And then also you have that feeling when you walk around Turkish cities, you see Syrians living in poverty. You see people who are not, they first of all don't have the right to work by and large. A lot of people sort of fall through the cracks of the system and therefore don't get education for their kids. They don't get, you know, the kind of aid that would be needed to sort of look after them. You see levels of poverty of Syrian refugees in cities, you know, like Istanbul, for instance, which is almost, I'm sorry to say, Dickensian in its scale. You know, you see kids out without shoes on the street. You see young boys peddling tissues on the street. So all these kind of things as a domestic issue, yes, there's been hospitable in the sense that they've given them somewhere to be. And with some help from the EU in terms of money, there's been, you know, refugee camps started to be built and so on. But also, I think that happened a little bit late, and therefore you created a sort of endemic poverty problem about Syrians living in Turkey.
How much, if any, popular sympathy is there for them? Are there, you know, sort of non-governmental efforts to reach out to the Syrian refugees or to help them out, or do people just regard them as a nuisance and wish they would go home, whether or not they actually have a home to go to at this point?
I mean, in many ways, the government has done a lot of outreach to Syrian refugees in terms of, you know, basically through Erdogan himself making these very public calls, saying, you know, our brothers in Syria and so on, these kind of things. From the Turkish side, from the sort of your average people, though, I think I have to say there's a good deal of suspicion there. You know, people are concerned about the fact that these people have fled a war. Who are these people? Who are the, you know, what are they going to bring to Turkey? What are they going to bring in terms of trouble to Turkey? And if we look over the past year, there's some, you know, several bombs that have taken place in major Turkish cities. Quite often one of the things that people talk about is, oh, you know, this, if you look for the one that happened last weekend, this person came from Syria. So for a lot of Turks, I think that's a big concern. It's like, is this actually being handled in a way where our security is going to be valued? And of course, that's obviously something that European Union countries think about as well.
And just one more, Chris. Do you get a sense from, or a better sense, I guess, from inside Turkey itself than we do from outside Turkey, what it is Turkey actually wants in Syria? What is Recep Tayyip Erdogan's idea of a successful end game from his perspective?
I mean, from his perspective now, the biggest concern for him is the creation of a Kurdish state in the north of Syria. That is absolutely what he's concerned about. They've done the most incredible about turn on their policy towards Assad and towards Syria. For a long time, they were actively supporting and financially supporting rebels in Syria itself. And then now he's talking about, well, there's a possibility in a transitional period Assad might have to remain. And as they get closer to Russia, they're going to have to deal with this. This is the new normal for Turkey, that if they're going to have these relationships with Russia that they would like, they're therefore going to have to accept that Assad is going to be part of the equation. And I think, you know, in terms of an end game, this end, it's possibly become a little bit unclear now. But it would seem to me that the no-fly zone will probably be top of Turkey's demands, which they've asked for so many times before. And what will happen towards, if the territorial integrity of Syria is to remain, there's going to be a possibility of seeing Syrian government troops going to war with the YPG, with the Kurdish militias in the north. And that is an extraordinary thing to think about, but it's definitely what Erdogan would want, to remove those Kurdish militias in the north of Syria.
Matt, what have you made of reaction in the West over the last few days in particular? There's been a fairly hefty measure of theatrical hand-wringing about the sort of the fall of Aleppo or the recapture of Aleppo, I guess, depending on which way you want to look at these things. This has been going on for 4 years. Why is it? Is this basically people deciding to get upset about it in lieu of having actually done anything at all to stop it?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's been the same for the last 4 years. You've got Western powers effectively saying very much the same things, which is, you know, the humanitarian situation is terrible. What Russia's been doing is appalling. And those things are all absolutely right. But what, you know, what has constantly been happening is the West has been there hand-wringing, as you say, and not acting. It's always been tough, though. You know, I think Western powers have been in a double bind ever since the war started. You know, the legacy of Iraq and Afghanistan was always there in the background, and that's what led to the UK voting not to have any part in the Syrian civil war, and Obama has had a similar a similar perspective on it, that he doesn't feel like, you know, even when Syria crossed that red line of chemical weapons, you know, he didn't feel like he could actually, the US forces on the ground could make the situation any better.
Are we learning the hard way then, Matt, or I guess were we learning the hard way, the people of Aleppo have learned the even harder way, what it looks like if and when, as so many people have been demanding for decades now, the West actually does get out of the Middle East?
Exactly. I mean, you can see what happens when you create a vacuum. This is exactly what's happened. We said that, you know, the deal that was brokered was Russia, Turkey, Syria and Iran. The US haven't been anywhere near these deals. And you can see what damage it does. I mean, Russia has basically been acting completely without conscience in Syria. And, you know, while there are obviously ways you can talk about the Iraq and Afghanistan campaigns, there were huge faults in them. But, you know, there's a problem there where you basically realize that the West it's impossible for the West to negotiate with Russia when it's acting without conscience like this. And Russia is now the power broker in the Middle East. It has completely dominated this space as the US has left a vacuum.
Okay, well, let's move along now to Switzerland, a country which, as a point of national pride, does its own thing in its own way, in its own time. This is not always a positive, as might be confirmed by any Swiss women who fancied voting in federal elections before 1971. Swiss participation in the EU single market has forced some compromises, however, such as today's passing of a law which will, so its sponsors hope, curb immigration by giving locals the first shot at jobs. This does fall short of the absolute quotas wanted by voters, however. I didn't mean to rhyme that. Quotas wanted by voters. Henry Rhys Sheridan joins us now. Henry, it's something I've never figured out about Switzerland myself. Does it have an unusually hostile attitude to immigration, or just an unusually honest one?
Well, I think that they're obviously in a difficult position with regards to the splits within the country. You know, different groups feel differently about different groups of immigrants. So hostility in Britain, as we've seen, and it seems in America over the last year to immigration, which led to the Brexit vote, you know, the vote of Donald Trump, seems to be towards the type of immigrants who are, you know, of a different colour, coming over here, taking our jobs, etc., etc., normally towards the lower end of the economic spectrum. Obviously, in Switzerland, you have a large number of people who fit that description, but you also have an extremely large expat, very highly paid business community at the same time. So the business community have arguably an even more vested interest than business communities in other Western European nations at not making getting talent over the border very difficult. And I think that this has been one of the reasons that the immigration debate over there has been so hard fought. There's also, and I think more to the point, the thing that's kind of caused this headache is the direct democracy mechanism that they've got out there, which meant that the Nationalist Party could, you know, hold a referendum, trigger a referendum, excuse me, in February 2014. And embed a deadline clause in that referendum, which has forced Swiss politicians to have to figure something out by this coming February. And that really is what caused the biggest headache in this instance.
That referendum was an extremely near run thing, carried 50.33 to 49.67, but it did endorse a restriction of freedom of movement. Matt, leaving aside whether you may or may not personally agree with that or not, do you think that right now there is a single country in the EU in which such a referendum would not be carried?
It's almost impossible. I mean, like, I can think of maybe one country. I think Portugal might be the one example of a country that is still saying quite openly across the country, yes, we want people to come in. But, you know, that's a small economy and it's coming out of a long, long crisis. And they have very smartly realised that with Brexit, they can steal a few jobs from the UK. You know, they're really pushing the entrepreneurial scene there. I was in Lisbon a couple of days ago and met with the mayor. And, you know, they're really pushing the entrepreneurial scene, the tech scene, they've done quite amazing things there. But apart from that, I can't see another country in the EU that would talk about not having restrictions on freedom of movement right now.
What do you think, Chris? Is this something the EU does need to address, possibly even with a view to, if not necessarily keeping the UK in, then keeping the UK as a sort of associate member? The idea that maybe as an idea or an ideal, freedom of movement is not something which quite a lot of the European public is on board with.
I mean, I think as Matt just said, you know, can you think of a country that would possibly, you know, not have that kind of referendum at the moment? I mean, I think, you know, what strikes me about this, of course, yeah, the freedom of movement thing is key to the European Union's ideology, but it's the kind of belligerence towards countries that start to question it in some respects. You know, I mean, even if you look at the way that they're responding to Switzerland's call, there's a sort of, you know, oh, you can't have your cake and eat it, you know, this kind of attitude. And sort of coming from my perspective a little bit in Turkey, don't get me wrong, Turkey does things that I disagree with regards to the EU, but sometimes if you look at the way that they talk to Turkey, and then you kind of wonder why Turkey gets so belligerent back. It's this sort of, it seems in the last few years, as the European Union has become under threat, their attitude just has become very, very belligerent to any sort of thing that would question the foundation of it.
I think, yeah, on that note, if you look at the specific example of the relations between EU and Switzerland in this regard, now obviously Switzerland is not a member of the EU, but it does have an extraordinarily elaborate and extensive set of trade agreements with them, which kind of sets out a power arrangement. And there is a guillotine clause attached to maintaining freedom of movement on the part of the Swiss, imposed by the EU on that. Now, they are very, very, very serious about enforcing that, and that was proven back in March 2014, where immediately following the vote, the Swiss failed to ratify some agreements on freedom of movement of new member states, and the EU immediately banned Swiss students from participating in the Erasmus exchange program, which enables students from all over the continent to study in different countries, and considered banning Swiss scientists from their Horizon research program too. So, you know, they have teeth in this regard, and they're not scared to use them.
Matt, is there a potential model here, or might people attempting to extricate Britain from the EU desperately want to see a potential model here for how the UK could in the future still effectively remain part of the single market while not being part of the EU? We have heard a lot of chat, some of it hopeful, some of it derisory about the Norway model or the Canada model. Is there perhaps a Swiss model?
Absolutely. I mean, I know that, you know, you can just see Britain's negotiators watching this very carefully and very delightedly kind of licking their lips if this goes ahead, because it's put the EU and the Commission in a really difficult position, because they have, you know, Switzerland has this kind of unique set of privileges, basically. They have privileged access to the single market, even though they're not in the EU. And, you know, the UK, I can imagine the negotiators saying, yes, the UK is a much bigger economy. We're a much more important player. We have much more to offer in terms of defence spending, in terms of counter-terrorism. And I can imagine them saying, yeah, if Switzerland can cherry pick a few things, then why can't we? And in a more, you know, go even further really than this referendum.
Just a final thought on this one from you, Chris. You were talking there about the belligerence with which the EU does tend to react to any questioning of its fundamentals, and you're quite right to do so. But how far would the EU really hold the line against, especially if their important wealthy countries start saying, well, actually, we do want to cherry pick. These are the things we won't put up with. These are the things we do want, take it or leave it.
Yeah, I mean, one has to respect the fact that they do stick to their guns, and this is what they believe, and they don't compromise on it. And, you know, and the irony of it, I just think what strikes me about this whole thing is that why can't even the idea be discussed amongst in the EU? Why does it have to be thrown out of the window every time in a way that's sort of like, well, if you don't like it, then you better go kind of thing, or, you know, that kind of mentality, rather than saying, look, how do we evolve this model? Maybe the model needs to evolve further. Maybe we need to do other things with it to make sure we keep people happy and make sure we don't have more Brexits, basically.
I don't think that the EU has figured out if it has a democratic reflection or guardianship relationship to the population of the continent yet. I think that that's a fundamental dynamic of tension within it as an institution.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Matt Alagaya, Chris Lord and Henry Rhys Sheridan. Coming up next, a possibly stupid question. 2016, has it really been all bad?
Hankering for a few ideas for the year ahead, or in mind of some reflection on the one that was. Monocle's mighty whacker of a December-January double issue is on newsstands now. What more could you want this festive season? Well, here's what our elfin editors have wrapped up for you.
In design, we get behind the green revolution that has sprung up in line with the growing popularity of the humble houseplant.
In the edit section, we stock up on stocking fillers in the Slovenian capital. From toys to books, clothes and a few well-designed delights, we present the finest presents from Ljubljana.
Monocle's Mammoth December-January double issue is on newsstands now. Pick up a copy today, or why not treat yourself to a subscription? Head to monocle.com to find out more.
You are back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Matt Alagaya, Chris Lord and Henry Rhys Sheridan. Now, as every 2016 retrospective you read, watch or hear over the next fortnight or so will confirm, this has been 12 months in which all sorts of things which weren't supposed to happen insisted on happening, and all the wrong famous people died. But has it all been so terrible? What we're going to try and do now is think of one thing each about 2016, which has actually been pretty cool. And I'm going to start. It has been noted, the bizarre rash of sporting upsets, specifically here in the UK, Leicester City winning the Premier League. But my two favourites were the Chicago Cubs winning the World Series and the Western Bulldogs winning the Australian Football League Grand Final. I don't really care about baseball, though I have seen the Chicago Cubs at home at Wrigley Field. I care far too much about Australian football, though I'm not a Western Bulldogs fan, but for listeners who may be unfamiliar, they're kind of the Chicago Cubs of the setup. They hadn't won a damn thing for years. They'd won one Premiership ever in 1954. They hadn't played in a grand final since 1961. They come from a proverbially struggling part of Melbourne that's the working class western suburbs of Melbourne. There's an enormous pride around their club. And this year, they, despite their kind of talismanic captain doing his knee early on in the season, they still somehow got up and actually won the thing. And and they've conducted themselves since with sort of terrific humility and grace. And it has been a reminder of how sport can transcend the football field and can become a real anchor of a community, an agent of social cohesion, and just, you know, a genuinely inspiring spectacle. It was lovely to watch, and I'm not a Bulldogs fan.
I'm going to add rugby to that as well, because the English rugby team this year, since Terry Jones came on, unblemished record. I mean, that is just incredible sequence of wins. I mean,
it is indeed. But you have a non-sporting good thing about 2016?
I do have a non-sporting good one. Well, I think the Cuba story was just amazing that happened this year. You know, this beginnings of rapprochement. I mean, obviously, it's still got a long way to go, and we have to see what's going to happen when Mr. Trump comes into power. But just the fact that you have this country that's sat in this sort of nexus of being unknown for so long, and, you know, mired in that astonishing embargo that's just a change. Just, you know, can you think of another country that's been, apart from maybe Iran, that has felt the brunt of such a strong embargo like that, and how it shapes society? So, in a way, you know,
North Korea is the last place that's still that isolated, but that's slightly out of their choice as well, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely, of course. And I just think with the Cuba scenario, you know, you have, it is a sort of, it is a little glimmer of hope when you look around. Yeah, I mean, North Korea is maybe a little bit more of an extreme example, but if I might, closer to me in Iran, for instance, it gives me hope that these old rivals can kind of put things aside and start talking to each other.
What I liked about the Cuba thing was that it was just very much Obama finally being the guy just standing up and saying, we're just doing this because we do this.
Yeah.
And it's dumb and it's not accomplishing anything and we should stop. Mm. It was one of those daft ideas that had just taken on a momentum of its own, as they often do.
Yeah, exactly. And saying, let's move on. Let's write a new page in history. And that's why I think that Iran, you know, the relationship between with Iran as well, you know, looking towards a nuclear deal, looking towards some sort of rapprochement, you can actually get these two old rivals to sit down and talk to each other.
Going around the table, Matt, next.
Yes, next up. I think I was going to talk about Sadiq Khan, because I think it's amazing that a major Western city now has a Muslim mayor. He became mayor in May this year, obviously a month before the referendum on Brexit. But I think it's an amazing thing, and it's a huge achievement for London as a city. With all of the kind of, you know, all of the sort of domestic politics that we see at the moment, with the rise of the far right, or at least populist parties who are basically anti-Muslim and anti-Islam across the West, it's nice to see that it's endearing to see that we have a mayor who is, you know, has risen up through one of our political parties and has become mayor of the biggest city in the country. I would say that I probably want him to be a bit more vocal on Brexit. I think as the mayor of a liberal capital, I think he should be out there, you know, every day on the front pages saying, this is what London wants from the Brexit negotiation. I don't see him doing that enough. But yeah,
you're right. Though, there was something encouraging about it, because he is someone himself who wears his faith very lightly, regards it as a private matter, and fine. And I like the fact that London has not only got that and went along with that, but did so despite a frankly thoroughly disgraceful campaign run by his opponent, Zach Goldsmith, who tried every possible insinuation you could possibly make, short of going completely over the top about Sadiq Khan's faith. And I really like the fact that nobody bought it. And, you know, Zach Goldsmith clearly running in a city which is prepared to elect a Conservative mayor. Zach Goldsmith didn't lose it because he was a Conservative. He lost it because I think Londoners saw straight through what he was doing and didn't like it at all.
Exactly. I mean, Boris Johnson was, as you say, a Conservative mayor, but he was someone who was pro-immigration broadly, even though he's now part of the Brexit cabinet. But he was broadly pro-immigration and still kind of is. He's a liberal guy. And I think that was the fundamental thing. That was Zach Goldsmith, as you say, he ran basically a racist campaign, and Londoners, didn't buy it. It's great.
Henry Rhys Sheridan, your not terrible thing for 2016.
So my not terrible thing for 2016 is Solar Impulse 2 circumnavigating the world, and in doing so, becoming the first solar-powered aircraft to make that journey. And the reason that this excites me so much is because I have chosen to navigate the fraught topography of our new dystopian political landscape by becoming a full-blown Brave New World technocrat. And I think only technology can save us. And I think the more successful projects like this are realised, the better. And apparently, humans are incapable of choosing not to use the technology which is going to destroy the world. So the only way that we can save ourselves is by making the technology better. So it was a Swiss project as well, just to shine some better light on that nation than perhaps we did in the earlier discussion. well done to the whole team behind Solar Impulse 2. It's a pretty crazy machine. I like it.
Okay, well, finally tonight, another thing other than retrospectives of 2016 that you will probably watch during the next fortnight is a Christmas film, despite the fact that, one, you've almost certainly seen it several times before, and two, they're almost all terrible. At which point, I would like to ask each of the panel what their favourite Christmas movie is and why. I will go first, and I know this is in much the same way that people who think they're being really cool and edgy about their favourite Christmas song will always say Fairy Tale of New York by the Pogues, which is also my favourite Christmas song. My favourite Christmas movie actually is Bad Santa. I am that predictable. It is genuinely very funny. I think it's actually quite heartwarming at the end. I won't give away the ending for those who haven't had the pleasure. I haven't seen the sequel, Bad Santa 2, which I'm sure is dreadful, as sequels almost always are, but I have a massive affection for Bad Santa. Before I go round the table, I will say that no one's allowed to say Love Actually, because otherwise none of these are ejector seats, unfortunately, but I would wish that they were. Chris, first of all.
Well, I mean, you're probably going to say that this is not a Christmas movie, but for me, like, at Christmas is absolutely Groundhog Day. Like, every time I go, I mean, I know it's got snow in the film, so that for me makes it a Christmas film. But whenever I go back to
It is, as you point out, it's so not a Christmas movie, it's actually named after a completely different holiday.
We should do
a segment on, what's your favourite Groundhog Day movie? Well, Andrew, it's...
Yeah, just by virtue of having seen it so many times at Christmas, it's become a Christmas film for me. And in fact, whenever I go back to my family home, it's always on every single... It's a bit like Groundhog
Day. That's a bit kind of meta, isn't it?
It is a little bit, yeah. We've been here before, you know.
It is a great film, though. There is absolutely nothing wrong with it. And weirdly, in that meta way, it does actually reward repeated viewings.
Absolutely, yeah, I think it is. I mean, the Dalai Lama himself gave it his seal of approval, so, yeah.
My favourite bit's where he hits the insurance salesman. That just always makes me laugh. Though that's not a terribly Christmassy sentiment. Henry, I'm going anti-clockwise. No, I'm going clockwise around the table this time.
So this is a potentially controversial choice. It's one of the very few films that I remember, Christmas film that I remember watching as a child. It is Jim Carrey as the Grinch.
Oh, great.
Now, one of the reasons that I like it so much is I think that Jim Carrey is one of our great physical comedians. I think that he is underrated as such, and I think that his full physical gesticular repertoire is on show in this film. I would recommend that listeners go and give it let's be honest, it's probably not a rewatch, a watch. Let me know what you think. hrs@monocle.com. I'm open to your thoughts.
I mean, at the risk of being the guy who says I really like the book, I did really like the book, the actual Dr. Seuss How the Grinch Stole Christmas, which is a wonderful, wonderful piece of writing. I'm a big fan of the whole Seuss oeuvre. Indeed. Is that the first time anybody's ever said the Seuss ooze?
I think probably. That was the second.
There will be an indie rock group called that in Dalston within a week. Matt?
I would like to say It's a Wonderful Life, because, I mean, I know it's kind of cheesy and I know it's the go-to Christmas film, but I really do watch it every year. And I think part of why I like it is that there's nothing kind of schmaltzy. I mean, very schmaltzy at the end, but it's actually, most of the film is, like, incredibly depressing. Downward spiral of a man's life after he's declared bankrupt and even ponders killing himself. And I just think there's, like, something quite odd about that you'd make a Christmas film, which is supposedly when you sit down with your entire family and, like, yeah, crack open a bottle of port or whatever.
Really good fun to show it to someone for the first time and stop at 20 minutes early, wouldn't it?
Exactly, yeah. And I just think it's quite nice that most of it is not very schmaltzy at all. It's actually quite brutal.
Okay, we have about 30 seconds left, which does give us a chance to discuss, is there actually a worse Christmas film than Love Actually? Can anybody think one?
I mean, Elf. Come to mind. To me, Elf. You're going in for Elf. Brutal.
I know, I'm sorry, but we did have a clip of it in the menu of this show.
That is true, and it is bad.
It is terrible, yeah.
There's no time for a counter-argument now, is there?
No, there really
isn't. I've got the last word, brilliant.
Yeah, well, you kind of have 5 seconds if anybody has an advance on Love Actually or Elf.
No, I don't.
Big Will Ferrell fan over there.
Okay, yeah. Well, There it is then. It is settled. Matt Alagaya, Chris Lord and Henry Rhys Sheridan, thanks for joining us at Midori House. That is all for today's episode. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alexis Sogol. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's music next at 1900. Marcus Hippie is in with the menu. I'll have more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House will be taking a break over Christmas. It will, of course, be back in the new year, but you can enjoy Monocle 24 special holiday coverage over the next fortnight. Or, of course, you could go to our website and listen to all the shows we've broadcast all year. You could spend all of your Christmas holiday doing that. What better way? Until then, however, happy Christmas, Merry New Year, or the other way around. I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening.